The move to Washington was as much for Marie's well-being as for Vince's restoration. She'd braved 10 snowy winters in Green Bay, and though she'd tried to put the best public face on it, she'd dearly missed the East Coast and metropolitan life. During the previous year, after her husband retired to the front office, she'd longed for the action of being a coach's wife as much as he'd yearned to return to the sideline. Her occasional overuse of alcohol and prescription drugs to numb her pain had become more frequent and alarming to her family. "I've got to get her out of here," Vince had said one winter's day in Green Bay when she had drunk too much at a game. Now he had kept his word, got her out of there with the promise of a new life and new home. The outside world knew none of this internal trauma. In social settings, Marie seemed optimistic and vibrant, and in her first public comments in Washington, she sounded as certain of her role as her husband was. "I feel sorry for the women who have to find their niche in life and can't," she said. "I never wanted to be anything but be married to Vin." The Lombardi stayed in Suite 675 at the Mayflower Hotel for most of February 1969. Vince walked to work from there, while Marie went out looking for a new house with Jackie Anderson, a longtime friend from Arlington who was the wife of Packer scout Lou Anderson, and Connie Boyle, a young real estate agent who worked for W.C. and A.N. Miller Company. On the afternoon of February 18th, Marie and Jackie returned to the hotel in late afternoon after house hunting and were surprised to find Lombardi already there. He'd left the Redskins' office early with what the newspapers the next day, reporting what the team publicist told them, called a heavy cold. "He said he didn't feel good and needed a doctor," said Anderson. She called her husband, the scout, who quickly found Dr. Phil James at the Washington Clinic and asked him to make a house call at the Mayflower. From a few preliminary questions, Dr. James determined that this was far worse than a cold. Lombardi was feverish, urinating frequently, and had a sore lower back near the kidneys. Dr. James contacted a urologist at his clinic, Dr. Landon Bamfield, and asked him to come to the hotel. Dr. Bamfield, a Redskins fan who'd played football through his freshman year at Princeton, was thrilled at first to be called to see Vince Lombardi. When he arrived at the suite at 8 p.m., Marie and Jackie were waiting in the outer living room, along with Lou Anderson and a few assistant coaches. And there sat the coach, still dressed in shirt and loosened tie. He had refused to go to bed. Dr. Bamfield took him into the bedroom for an examination. Lombardi was shaking, had chills, and his temperature was 102 degrees. The diagnosis? He had a roaring urinary tract problem, probably prostatitis, an infection of the prostate. Dr. Bamfield treated him with ampicillin and said he would check on him again in a few days. When they emerged from the bedroom, Dr. Bamfield recalled later, Marie gave him a look like, "Oh God, what have you done to my husband?" 3 days later, Lombardi visited Dr. Bamfield's office. He was sweating profusely, but the kidney pain had diminished and his fever was gone. 1 week later, Dr. Bamfield brought him in for a third checkup and performed a more thorough examination. Lombardi's blood pressure was 120 over 60. He told the doctor that he'd had no serious ailments in his life, glossing over a long line of problems going back to his sophomore year at Fordham, when he'd been knocked unconscious and was hospitalized with internal bleeding in his lower intestinal tract. Urine tests indicated that the infection had improved, and a rectal exam revealed no noticeable mass in Lombardi's prostate. But his reaction to the rectal exam was one that Dr. Bamfield would long remember. "He hated the rectal exam," Dr. Bamfield said later. "He screamed so loudly the nurses came running into the room. He was very unhappy about it." That was the last time Lombardi would see Dr. Bamfield. After he recovered from that bad spell, as Marie later called it, he still seemed tired all the time, especially in private, when only she was around. This renewed her nagging concerns about his overall health, reminding her once again of how exhausted he'd been during his final year coaching the Packers. She pleaded with him to go in for a complete physical, including a proctoscopy to check for tumors in his colon. But he ignored all such entreaties from Marie and Dr. James, just as he had in Green Bay. No way he would let any doctor do that, he said. This was part of Lombardi's squeamishness and stubbornness that Marie knew all too well. Her husband had just arrived in Washington. His first game with the Redskins was still a long way off, and as she noted later in a letter to their son Vincent, of course he couldn't quit. Marie's outlook brightened somewhat when Connie Boyle showed her a house that had just been constructed at 11013 Stanmore Drive in Potomac Falls, an upscale development in suburban Maryland beyond the Beltway, about 45 minutes by car from downtown. It was a spacious four-bedroom colonial made of orangish tan brick with yellowy cream trim, designed on the slope of a hill so that the paneled family room in the basement opened out to an expansive two-acre yard. Stone steps led up a manicured terrace from the two-car garage on the side to the front portico. "This is my dream house. This is what I want," Marie said. And though Lombardi had preferred an old house closer to town in the Somerset neighborhood, he deferred to his wife, saying, "I promised her she could have whatever she wanted." Edward Bennett Williams called Boyle to see if he could get the price down. Another contest, what he thought life was all about. But the young widow with five children held firm, kept the price at $125,000 and made the deal of her lifetime. When the contract was signed, she came home with an autographed picture of the coach for one of her boys. Lombardi would not be home much in any case. There was a football team to turn around, and he went about it the same way he had in Green Bay a decade earlier. Repetition had always been his mantra, so there was no reason for him not to repeat what had worked for him before. Again, he assembled a coaching staff of loyalists, looking not for innovative young football minds or future head coaches, but seasoned pros who understood his methods and could carry out his directives. From his early Green Bay days, he brought back Lou Carpenter, one of his first halfbacks, and Bill Austin, his first line coach, recently fired as head coach of the Steelers. He wanted to hire two of his retired players, Forrest Gregg and Zeke Bratkowski, but the Packers would not allow it. For the defense, he turned to Harlan Sver, who had played for him with the Giants. George Dixon was hired to coach the backfield with a glowing recommendation from Bob Blake, the colonel's son. Don Dahl and Mike McCormick were retained from the Graham regime. What kind of material did they have? Lombardi had been studying game films every night and assigned each of his assistants to assess the players at each position. He took the quarterbacks himself, by far the easiest task. Sonny Jurgensen had been in the league for a dozen years, and Lombardi had always loved the way he passed. The films confirmed his impressions. Jurgensen was the best pure thrower he'd ever seen, with a quick release and unerring accuracy. "My God," he was heard muttering in the darkness of the film room one day, "if we'd had him in Green Bay." His voice trailed off. Bart Starr had been his brain on the field, the most committed and disciplined of his ballplayers. But in terms of pure talent, he wasn't in the same category as Jurgensen. Jurgensen's reputation as a playboy didn't bother Lombardi. If anything, it reminded him of his favorite son in Green Bay, Paul Hornung. The golden boy might break curfew, but he had an uncommon talent and didn't waste it. He was the best money player Lombardi'd coached. People who didn't know Lombardi often held the misimpression that he expected his players to be as conservative in their private lives as he appeared to be. That is what Jurgensen feared at first. When he heard that the old man was coming to Washington, he called Hornung and asked,
Jesus, Paul, what am I to expect?
Hornung chuckled and said, Sonny, you're gonna love the guy. Lombardi announced at his opening press conference that he was giving Jurgensen a clean slate and noted that despite his autocratic image, he'd never been obsessed with rules. The city of Washington may have a lot of bars, but I assure you, Green Bay has 15 times more, he said. We will have as few rules as we can get away with. After his first meeting with Lombardi, Christian, Adolph, Jurgensen came away saying he wished the season could start the next day.
Who would carry the ball? George Dixon studied films of the returning running backs and presented Lombardi with a pessimistic assessment, the last line of which read, If we are going to win here, none of these guys will be here when we do.
Lombardi was a realist. He knew that Dixon was probably right, but the report angered him nonetheless. He came in after he read my assessment, threw that paper on my desk and said, God damn it, but you've got to coach 'em. Maybe you don't think these men are any good, but you've got to coach 'em. Dixon recalled. I said, I know I got to coach 'em, but you only asked me what I thought of 'em.
It was typical of Lombardi to expect the world to bend his way. He established the expectations, the routine, and people adjusted. The barber at the Mayflower knew when to expect him for his weekly haircut. The administrative staff quickly learned about Lombardi time and arrived at meetings 10 to 15 minutes early. His assistant coaches knew that they'd be expected to work late on Monday nights and go to Duke Zebert's for dinner. He'd been a daily early morning communicant at St. Willibrord during his years in Green Bay and wanted to establish the same pattern in Washington. One morning, a priest answered a knock at the door of St. Matthew's Cathedral, and there stood a man who introduced himself as Vince Lombardi. What time was the first daily mass? Lombardi wanted to know. At 7:30 a.m. came the reply. Why don't you change it to 7? It would fit my schedule better, Lombardi said. The priest was a kind man. It amused him that a football coach would try to reschedule his mass, but that was asking a bit much. Lombardi might be bigger than the president, but there was still a higher order. Devoting endless hours to the film room, watching, rewinding, grading, was second nature to Lombardi. He'd been doing it for 20 years, since he joined Red Blake's staff in 1949. But it could never replace the thrill he felt being around players. Even this off-season, during which he had far more than usual to do as he analyzed what it would take to make winners of the Redskins, seemed far too long for him. He visited relatives in New York, played golf with Aki Kruger at Congressional and Burning Tree, attended more social functions in Georgetown in a few months than he had in Green Bay in years, but still, he was itching to get on with it. Marie saw the telltale sign. They'd been in their new home only 2 months when he started cleaning the closets. On the evening of June the 9th, the Lombardi sat in the steamy armory at the College of St. Thomas and St. Paul and watched their son receive his law degree from William C. Mitchell Law School. Vincent was 27. And he and Jill now had 3 young children. 3-year-old Vincent II, 2-year-old John, and baby Gina, 5 months. As his father said of him that day, it was a long, hard pull for the young man. He had entered the University of Minnesota Law School after graduating from St. Thomas, but dropped out, uncertain that he wanted to be a lawyer. He reconsidered and attended Mitchell at night, while working several jobs, first at a bank, then an insurance company, then a law office. Newspapers in the Twin Cities, which published feature articles about his graduation, noted that in getting his law degree he was following in the footsteps of his famous father. It was reported that Lombardi received a law degree from Fordham but never used it, choosing instead to go into coaching. Of course, this was one of the old Lombardi myths. He'd dropped out of Fordham Law during his first unimpressive year there. In his rhetoric,
Lombardi had little use for quitters or losers. Success, he liked to say, is not a sometime thing, it's an all-the-time thing. He called it a matter not so much of talent and not so much of opportunity, but rather of concentration and perseverance. Vincent had struggled with this philosophy for most of his life, fearing that he could never live up to his father's expectations. But here was one time when he'd persevered, when his father had quit. He went back to law school, he said, because he didn't think he could compete with his dad in the world of sports. He'd been as uncertain about whether he truly wanted to be a lawyer as his father had been. He had a family to support during law school, while his father had still been single, and yet he kept going and got the degree. Vincent, as his dad and Colonel Blake would put it, had paid the price. "I think maybe I appreciate the degree more because I had to work for it," he said. Lombardi never seemed prouder. "My son, the lawyer," he boasted. "God, family, and the Washington Redskins." After mass the next morning, before rushing back to D.C. to make final preparations for the season, Lombardi announced to the press that Vincent and Jill and their children would be moving to Washington later that summer, arriving in time for the first exhibition game. On June 16th, Lombardi was finally with his football players, taking his first look at candidates for the Redskins roster at a four-day mini-camp of skull sessions and drills on Kehoe Field at Georgetown University. The first practice was scheduled for 2 p.m., and most of the players were there 20 minutes before, revealing an early appreciation of Lombardi time. Tom Brown, the former strong safety of the Packers, showed up, having been acquired in a trade for a draft choice. He sensed the beginning of another era, convinced that players who stuck around Lombardi would someday feel on top of the world. As passers and receivers went through basic drills, Lombardi was back in his element. No signs of physical exhaustion, no outward indications of worry, just pure football again. "I missed it more than I can say," he said. "It feels good to be back." That night, in the dressing room with his assistants, Lombardi expressed his private hopes and concerns about one of the running backs. Ray McDonald had been the team's number one draft choice in 1967 from the University of Idaho. On paper, he was an incredible talent. Huge, fast and powerful, 6'4" and 248 pounds. Edward Bennett Williams, in his most conspicuous intrusion into the realm of player personnel, had selected McDonald himself and had been disappointed by his choice's performance during his rookie year. Surely Lombardi could get the best out of him. It so happened that McDonald was gay. All the players and coaches knew it. Some felt uncomfortable about it and talked about him behind his back. Lombardi knew and didn't care. His brother Harold was gay. He'd made it a point throughout his coaching career that he would not tolerate discrimination of any sort on his teams. "George," he said to Dixon, "I want you to get on McDonald and work on him and work on him. And if I hear one of you people make reference to his manhood, you'll be out of here before your ass hits the ground." Confidence and fear. That was how Lombardi coached the game. He needed his quarterback to be confident, not afraid, and from the first day treated Jurgensen like a leader, something other coaches had been reluctant to do. They considered Sonny talented but self-oriented. Lombardi saw more. "Take him down to the goalpost, Sonny," he said at the start of practice on the third day. Jurgensen running ahead of the pack, an unheard-of thought before, but there he went, holding the lead for several strides. Sonny was Lombardi's man, and after only a few days he realized what that meant. Jurgensen had been around great quarterbacks much of his career, including Norm Van Brocklin in Philadelphia and Otto Graham in Washington. Yet it wasn't until he hooked up with the undersized guard from Fordham that he understood the best way to play his position. Lombardi's system, he said, was completely different from anything he'd seen before. It placed the emphasis on reading the defense and giving the quarterback fewer plays but more options.
as had happened to Bart Starr earlier. As soon as Jurgensen got into Lombardi's system, the game seemed to slow down. What had been chaotic suddenly made sense. Everything became clear and comprehensible. When training camp opened at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, at high noon on July 9th, Lombardi was surrounded by old friends and familiar faces. Not just Austin and Carpenter, Brown, Bob Long, and Kruger from his Green Bay days, but also Sam Huff, who'd played for him in New York and now came out of retirement for one last year, and his traditional army of priests, this time led by Father Guy McPartland, who'd played fullback for him at St. Cecilia, and Father Tim Moore, the jovial Carmelite, who'd been the athletic director there. Father Guy, who'd been known as Iggy in high school, said Mass for Lombardi in the morning and heard confession in the afternoon, then went to the traditional 5 o'clock club in shorts and T-shirt and knocked down scotches with everyone else. Father Tim preferred to go out on the field to run under Charlie Gogolak's kicks. Then chatter on the sidelines with Joe Paterno, the one-time Brooklyn Prep halfback visiting from the Penn State coaching staff, and Mike Minucci, the Manhattan restaurateur. Ed Williams came up from Washington, along with his pals Art Buchwald and Ben Bradley, whose young son Dino was a ball boy. Lombardi took one look at the shaggy-haired adolescent and compulsively barked out, "Get a haircut!" as though he was talking to his own son or one of the ball players. Dino showed up the next day with a crew cut. It was the same for Sam Huff as it was for the young ball boy. Lombardi ruled as the voice of authority. On the first night of camp, he gathered the squad together for his opening speech, similar to the one he'd delivered for 9 straight years in Green Bay, and though it was always effective, in this case, it hardly mattered what he said. All he had to do was gesture with his big hand and let his Super Bowl ring glisten in the light, and the message was clear. "He was like God himself to these players," George Dixon said. "This was the be-all and end-all of knowing how to win." He told the Redskins that night that he didn't have many rules. "But, gentlemen, there is just one thing that I want you to understand. If you do anything to embarrass me or the organization in any way, you will answer to me and me alone." Lombardi talked himself hoarse, riding the 7-man blocking sled, daring his linemen to knock him off, hollering at his troops during grass drills. He was a perfect gentleman in social settings and loved a good joke, but in the film room and on the football field, he couldn't stop cursing and yelling. His voice was so loud and his language so purple that a college official called David Slattery, Lombardi's administrative assistant, and asked whether he could tell the coach to calm down. When Slattery broached the subject with him, Lombardi seemed contrite. "You know, David, I don't understand it. I go to Mass, I never use bad language in my life until I get to the football season." Then he laughed and said, "I'll try to watch it." Many of the Redskins were not accustomed to Lombardi's style and had as hard a time with it as the college secretaries who'd complained to the dean. Within a week, 3 rookie draft choices from Ohio had bolted camp. Once, 15 years earlier, when 2 rookies named Sam Huff and Don Chandler had packed up and headed for the airport at the Giants' camp in Vermont, it was Lombardi who'd talked them back. This time he let the rookies go, berating the moral code, or lack of one, that would allow them to take signing bonuses and then go home. In some ways, he seemed as gruff as ever, especially when he was lost in thought on the football field. Joe Lombardi, his little brother, who was then a regional salesman for Rawlings Sporting Goods, visited camp with 2 company executives and approached the coach at afternoon practice to see if he had time to meet them. "Get the hell out of here and get those goddamn people out of here," Lombardi snapped. "But come on, Vince, these are my bosses," Joe pleaded. "I don't give a damn who they are," Lombardi said.
It wasn't that he didn't love Joe or didn't want to help him. In fact, Lombardi bought new uniforms from Joe that year and sparked a minor controversy by clothing his team in a color that he insisted was the traditional burgundy, but actually was a variation of rose. It was just a matter of habit. He'd been kicking people off his field indiscriminately ever since he became a coach. Despite his bluster at Carlisle, in fact, some people who'd been around him for years thought Lombardi had actually mellowed that summer. To me, he was not as aggressive, and I figured, well, he's just trying to feel his way around, Tom Brown recalled. But maybe he didn't have the energy, the enthusiasm, to do what he did in Green Bay. The other guys thought he was pushing them like crazy, but I'm thinking he doesn't have the same intensity. Brown's observation was discerning. Lombardi had lowered his intensity a notch and was struggling in private with his decision to come back to coach, something he would never admit in public. When Howard Cosell visited camp to do another piece on his favorite coach, Lombardi told him that he had no regrets.
"I want to say that I'm very, very happy that I am back," he declared.
But with a few confidants, he talked about feeling older and tiring more easily, and questioned whether his desire to coach had overpowered the common sense that led him to retire. "I don't know if I made the right decision," he told Father McPartland one night as the two men sat on the back porch of the house he had made his training camp headquarters. "I think I made the wrong decision." The priest at first thought he was talking about the prospects of a winning season and tried to encourage him by recalling how he turned the Packers around the first year in Green Bay. But Lombardi was also still hurting from the harshest portraits of him during his final years in Green Bay, and the criticism of him as a bully continued even now. George Wilson, coach of the Miami Dolphins, was quoted that summer insisting that he was just as good as Lombardi, but more humane. "I'm tired of all this Lombardi business. Everyone makes him out to be such a great coach," Wilson harumphed. "Given the same material, I'll beat him every time. I can get a team up on the day of a game. I ball guys out as much as Lombardi does, but I don't holler at a fellow in front of his teammates. I don't want to embarrass him. That's just a big show, and I'm not going to do it." Wilson finished 3-10-1 that year and was fired, ending a 12-year coaching career with 68 wins and 84 losses. In 10 years, Lombardi won 96 and lost 34. As training camp progressed, Dixon and Lombardi found their runner, though it was not McDonald or any of the other veterans, but an unheralded rookie from Kansas State named Larry Brown. From the scouting reports, there didn't seem to be much promise in Brown. He was relatively slow and small, had few moves and little experience catching passes out of the backfield. But he was fearless, with uncommon leg strength and terrific explosion off the ball. Dixon considered him the toughest runner he'd ever seen. Lombardi needed convincing. "You're always looking for tough guys," he said to Dixon early on. "Give me talent. I'll make them tough." He was also concerned about Brown's mental errors. He had a tendency to miss the snap count and go too early or too late. "Does that Brown hear?" Lombardi asked Dixon one night at a coach's meeting. "I don't know. He always turns his head one way when I'm talking," Dixon said. "God damn it, he must be deaf," Lombardi said. They fitted an earpiece in his helmet, and suddenly the error stopped. Brown played impressively in the exhibition opener at RFK Stadium, pounding through the mud and rain on two short touchdown runs, and when Dixon walked out to the practice field a few days later, he saw Lombardi standing with his arm draped around the rookie. "Son," Dixon said to him later during drills, realizing what the Lombardi drape meant, "you've got this ball club made." Lombardi was still at training camp when his son came out from St. Paul to begin a new life in Washington. Vincent and the boys flew out first, while Jill stayed with baby Gina until the movers loaded their furniture. By the middle of August, they were all staying in Marie's dream house on Stanmore Drive. In his few public comments, Vincent politely made it seem that he wanted to move to Washington, that it was his idea, or at least that he understood and agreed with his father's expressed desire to have the family close together. In fact, he didn't feel especially close to his parents then, and from the moment he arrived was uncertain about what he was doing there. Was this going to be another time when he couldn't meet his father's expectations? Lombardi had mentioned helping Vincent get a job at the Justice Department, but the talk seemed to evaporate when he finally got to town, and there were few contacts for Vincent to pursue. The old man was unavoidably too busy with the football team to spend much time with the family. Vincent understood this. He didn't blame his father, but merely felt awkward about it. He took his boys to Carlisle for a few days, and Lombardi enjoyed his limited time with his grandchildren, toting them around in his golf cart. Then what? Marie found a house that she wanted Vincent and Jill to buy, a few miles away from hers in Potomac. But to the young couple, it seemed unreasonably expensive. They had just bought Marie's station wagon, and between paying her and taking care of the moving van bill, they were out of money. Lombardi was a millionaire now, not from his Redskins holdings, but from the sale of public facilities, the housing company that David Carley had brought him into in Wisconsin. When Schultz Holmes bought the company on August the 17th, it was estimated that he had made $1.7 million from the sale. He was accumulating wealth at last, enough, he said, to take care of his family for the rest of their lives. The old man had good intentions. He wanted to create one big happy family, but it never quite seemed to work. Little John banged his head on the bathtub at Stanmore Drive and had to be taken to the hospital. Jill suffered a miscarriage during a troubled early pregnancy. She and Vincent decided to rent the house Marie had found for them rather than buy it, and Vincent finally found a job in a downtown law firm, but during the long drive into town every morning he asked himself, "Do I need this commute? I could be working for a law firm in Minnesota and life would be easier." The season had started, and Lombardi was back from training camp, preoccupied with his players and the next game. Marie seemed to love her house and the social whirl. She spent much of her time shopping in Georgetown with her friend Jackie Anderson. There were catered post-game parties at Stanmore Drive, the family room filled with celebrities. Joe DiMaggio, singer Martha Wright, Frank Gifford, television newswoman Nancy Dickerson, Ethel Kennedy. It was a wonderful life, or so it seemed. One day, Lombardi and his son were in the car together, and Vince said, "You think I've made a big mistake coming back, don't you?" Vincent took this remark as an indirect way for his father to express his own misgivings, and the implication surprised him. He never considered the possibility that his father doubted himself. It was he, not his dad, who'd made the mistake in coming to Washington, he thought. A few weeks later, he and Jill decided to move back to St. Paul. When Vincent broke the news to his parents, not much was said. Vince was preoccupied. Marie expressed herself largely through body language, according to Jill, who could sense that her mother-in-law was extremely upset. Not long after Vincent and his family left, Lombardi wrote a note to his daughter Susan, who'd moved to Chicago Heights, Illinois, with her husband and daughter Margaret Ann, and was pregnant again. Lombardi was an emotional man. He could cry while giving a speech to his football team. Yet he had rarely been able to express that same level of feeling with his own family. The letter to Susan was about as expressive as he got. "Dear Susan," he wrote, "enclosed, please find $100. Buy yourself something and something for Margaret Ann from her grandfather. I'm looking forward to seeing you at Thanksgiving. Regards to Paul, and give Margaret a kiss and remember I love you." His football team was winning that fall, never easily or impressively, but enough to maintain his status as the quintessential winner. Just having him there raised the public expectations, perhaps unreasonably, But there was a growing sense in Washington that Lombardi was creating another dynasty. After defeating the Giants 20-14 at RFK in the fifth game, the Redskins' record stood at 3-1-1, in second place in the East behind the Dallas Cowboys, and the post-game party at Stanmore Drive was especially festive. A band of Izzo cousins came down from New York and Baltimore, mixing with the Washington elite. A few days later, Ethel Kennedy wrote Lombardi a note on her Hickory Hill stationery. Dear Coach, many thanks for an exciting afternoon watching our favorite team, and also for the after-game victory celebration in your delightful home. I didn't think anybody had as many relatives as the Kennedys. I guess you know the greatest asset to the team is living right in the house with you. Basically, you realize it isn't Sonny's arm, but Marie's Hail Marys that pull us through every Sunday. The children and I are grateful to you both for sharing your box with us. With continued admiration and affection, Ethel Kennedy. P.S. Is it true you fired up the team at halftime by telling them it's only a game? For a year after Robert Kennedy's death, Ethel Kennedy had been in mourning, staying away from Washington's social life. When she'd begun appearing in public again that June, a year after the assassination, she immediately found comfort in Lombardi's presence. She first sat next to him at a party at Ben Bradley's house, and though he made her nervous at first, he quickly put her at ease, talking about his friendships with Jack Kennedy and her husband, and how they both had the qualities of great athletes. "His presence was so overwhelming," she said later, "that I forgot who else was in the room." Over time, as she saw more of the coach, in her prayers she thanked Bobby for sending Vince Lombardi to Washington to look after her. He was invariably polite in her presence, as was Marie, though in private Marie could be dismissive of the Kennedys. As a conservative Republican, she found President Nixon and Vice President Spiro Agnew more to her taste. Lombardi was moving that way himself, pushed away from his democratic roots by what he saw as the excesses of the counterculture, and pulled toward conservative Republicans by their growing hero worship of him. The Lombardi creed on discipline, respect for authority, and the American zeal to win had become the anthem of the business world. His second effort motivational film was then the best-selling film of its kind, pushed by insurance companies and corporations as the positive capitalist answer to Arthur Miller's dark Death of a Salesman. Patriotic groups reprinted his speeches and recruited him to join their causes. William O'Hara, a friend and classmate from Fordham, persuaded him to join a list of conservative figures supporting the Nixon administration's policies in Vietnam and development of the ABM defense system. O'Hara considered Lombardi by then very much to the right. In fact, he was not so much to the right as disturbed and confused by the cultural choices, and in an era of symbols, he became a symbol of old-fashioned conservatism. During his years in Green Bay, as he developed his strong rhetoric challenging the behavior of young anti-war protesters, Lombardi was speaking from a removed perspective. Green Bay, with its heavily Catholic working-class population, was largely isolated from the movement, its sons more likely to fight in Vietnam than march on the streets of Madison or Washington. But now that he was in Washington, he could see it all firsthand. Hundreds of thousands of anti-war protesters flooded into the city twice that fall. First, for an October 15th demonstration sponsored by the Vietnam Moratorium Committee, then a month later for what was called the MOB. The November 15th event, organized by a more confrontational wing of the peace movement, drew an enormous crowd, estimated by police at 250,000, and by others at twice that number. When the speeches ended at the Washington Monument, a few thousand young militants scrambled over to the Justice Department and incited a rocks and bottles versus tear gas melee with police. Attorney General John N. Mitchell looked down on the confrontation from his office and seized the opportunity to portray the anti-war movement as anarchistic, even though all but a small fraction of the demonstrators were peaceful. Lombardi's reaction was not precisely like Mitchell's, but he also worried about anarchy. Before and after the demonstrations, thousands of peace marchers had filled the sidewalks of Connecticut Avenue on their way to and from the mall, and the coach had watched them from his office window, lamenting the sight. The long hair, the seeming disregard for authority. What kind of courage did it take to be a college rebel? He wondered aloud. It's easy to break the law if there's impunity. I'd like to go out there and throw a rock through that window, if I knew the only thing I'm going to have is a reprimand. As a band of protesters passed below, he shook his head and said, "Look at that." George Dixon, his backfield assistant, snarled sarcastically that he would like to turn a machine gun on the crowd. "God damn it, that's your generation," Lombardi responded. In fact, Dixon was only 8 years younger than Lombardi and, unlike the coach, had served in the military. He'd been a paratrooper in World War II and still had his helmet with a bullet hole in it. But Dixon knew better than to argue with Lombardi when he thought he was right. The Sunday before the mob, Lombardi staged a patriotic counter-demonstration of sorts, a ceremony at halftime of the Redskins-Eagles game called The Flag Story. It was much like the patriotic show he'd put on at Lambeau Field the previous December. This one brought a letter of thanks from President Nixon. After first offering condolences that the game didn't turn out better for you and your Redskins, it was a 28-28 tie. The would-be coach in the White House was down on the defense. Nixon wrote, "You have always demonstrated on the field and off the qualities of faith and determination which are at the heart of true patriotism. I am very happy to know that the fans got to see such a wonderful and inspiring show of this kind at a time when it can do the most good." Lombardi received the letter at work and took it home to show his wife, the Nixon fan, who filed it away for posterity. Marie had other things on her mind that November. Worries about her husband's health, her future, family relationships, and decided to share them with her son, who was back in St. Paul starting a new job in the investment field. The following Friday, on her old Green Bay stationery, she wrote a letter that jolted Vincent and Jill with its tone, which vacillated between intense love, coldness, and despair, and its message, which indicated that Vince's dad was far sicker than anybody realized, and that she was more afraid than she had ever let on. "Dear son, the time has come to write this to clear the air and tell it like it is. First, chalk one up for Mom. I said all along you would wind up in the investment business. Good for you. You'll enjoy it, you'll be successful, and it will reward you with the excitement you need. Bravo. Now, let me explain my get-tough policy. I tried to tell you a few times that Dad is not well. Last spring, he had a bad spell while we were at the Mayflower. Kidney infection. He pulled out of it, but was tired all the time, and of course he couldn't quit. After that, he took his physical for insurance. He flunked. Heart. About 2 weeks ago, he became ill again, ran a high temperature, and was feeling generally lousy, but again he couldn't quit. Over last weekend, he started bleeding from his kidney, bladder, and prostate, who knows. He went into the hospital for some tests. He checks out fine, but they don't know what's causing the bleeding. Of course, they are looking for cancer. I have been absolutely frantic. Knew for a long time he just wasn't right. Now we're in a bind. And we all get into these binds, and all we can do is grin and bear it and mostly pray. Believe me, son, if anything happens to him, I will fold up my tent and go with him, 'cause there is no way I could live without him. I suddenly realized what a price I had paid for fame and fortune. I would have nothing. I could never end up like Nana and Pop-Pop, Mattie and Harry Lombardi. Sick, poor, unwanted, and unloved. It was always enough for me that Dad and I loved each other so much that everything else I had missed was all right. But the thought that I could lose him staggered me. So now I am going to get tough and try to protect him from anyone or anything else that might pressure him. No speaking or public appearances. No books or anything. It's just Dad and I, 'cause in the end, that's all we have. I am writing you this in absolute confidence. You are the only one who knows. Please don't even tell Jill, especially Sue, 'cause she worries so. I gathered from our talk, you're in the usual bind that comes from being young. You'll pull out of it. We always do. You've been a good son, and for that I'm grateful. But there has been one sorrow in my life, and that is you and your father were always so far apart. The one thing you didn't understand is that he is a very shy and lonely man, believe it or not. He is a very great, generous, wonderful man, and his whole life has been giving and doing things for me, you, and Sue. He sure didn't want anything for himself. All he ever asked was a thank you, and that's a word you never learned to say. I have been trying forever, it seems, to bring you two together, 'cause again, believe it or not, he really needs you. Oh, how he needs you. And you have made damn little effort to care, to love, or to understand him. So now I have to give up and face the fact that it can never be. All these years, I have fought your battles, softened him up, so to speak, and you let me, and now I know I was wrong. I also realize it was good you went back to Minneapolis, 'cause out of sight, out of mind, and that way no one gets hurt. We all thought that Dad would endure forever. At least I thought he was so strong. I can't tell you how frightened I am, but with lots of prayers, and if he takes it easy, and believe me, he will take it easy if I have my way, he will be okay. The next thing they want to do is x-ray his kidneys, 'cause his urine is cloudy and has a heavy odor. Also, the prostate is enlarged. This letter has rambled on, but that's my state of mind. I repeat, please keep this down to a roar. I have written this 'cause I think you should know, so you will understand a lot of things. So now I'll end this and ask you to pray. Just phone or write if you get time. All my love. Mom.
Vincent had a more complicated perspective on the struggle between father and son and his mother's role in it. He tended not to think of his mother as a unifying force, but rather as an insecure figure who jealously guarded her relationships, subtly turning one family member against another so that she would be the center of attention needed by everyone. And Vincent suspected something that she acknowledged to him later, that she could never love her children nearly as much as she loved her husband. As a medical report, Marie's letter is more revealing than the minimal documentary evidence concerning Lombardi's condition that fall. He had not gone back to doctors James and Bamfield since they treated him the previous February, but instead relied on the team physician, Dr. George Resta, who treated patients at Doctors' Hospital downtown. Resta died in 1977. The hospital closed in 1979, and any records that might have shown Lombardi's treatment that November are gone with them. Lombardi's administrative aides on the Redskins staff, including Aki Kruger and David Slattery, remember that he did pass his team physical. Later records indicate that a minor heart problem, moderate atherosclerosis of the aorta, was discovered only after his death, during a pathology report. But there's no reason to doubt the essential accuracy of Marie's account. She knew her husband better than anyone else, and the letter shows remarkable and tragic prescience.
her intuition taking her to a fearful place that doctors could not yet reach. Lombardi did not slow his busy schedule despite Marie's vows to protect him from outside interests. He gave speeches, accepted awards, made frequent jaunts up to New York, and continued his coaching duties without showing a hint of trouble to his assistants. Not long after Marie wrote the letter, Vince called two of his favorite old Packers, Paul Hornung and Max McGee, and asked them to come to Washington and hang out with his team. "I want these guys to see some winners," he told McGee. Lombardi invited them to stay at his house, and McGee almost accepted until Hornung talked him out of it. "No, no, no, Max. We're not going to stay 3 nights at Lombardi's. Shit, no way. Get us a suite." The trip probably meant more to Lombardi than to his players. McGee and Hornung visited the dressing room, but stood around joshing with a few friends, nothing more than that. Vince and Marie took them to dinner, and when they walked into Duke's, the patrons again gave Lombardi a standing ovation. "He pretended he was embarrassed as hell, but down deep he loved it," Hornung recalled. When it reached 11 o'clock, McGee started checking his watch, and Lombardi knew what that meant. "McGee, you guys haven't changed a bit. You want to get the hell out of here, don't you? Get the hell out of here." Perhaps Max and the Golden Boy made no difference, but the Redskins won that week, defeating Pittsburgh. Their offense, led by Jurgensen's accurate passing, completing 62%, and Larry Brown's toughness, gaining 888 yards, was explosive all year, but the defense remained inconsistent. In the next-to-last game against New Orleans, the Redskins broke out to a quick 17-0 lead, then held on to win 17-14, and the players gave Lombardi the game ball. 12 years of losing were done and gone. The club had assured itself of a winning record, finishing 7-5-2. It was the same winning percentage that Lombardi had during his first year in Green Bay, but he was disappointed. "I thought we could have had a better one-loss record," he said. "I hope we can find some better people. That's what we're going to have to do. Find them." In Green Bay, the talent was already there. And by his second year, he was taking the Packers to the championship game. That seemed less likely now. It was a more competitive league with smarter coaches, better scouting, and 26 teams instead of the old dozen. He went to Super Bowl IV in New Orleans that year, watching in the stands as the Kansas City Chiefs beat the Minnesota Vikings, the second straight loss for old NFL teams. Sonny Jurgensen was also there. They were too far apart to consult during the game, but every now and then they looked at each other and made hand gestures indicating what play they would have run against the Chiefs, nodding in agreement, the coach and his quarterback, both certain that soon enough they would be down on the field, playing for a championship and winning it. Chapter 28. Run to Win. Lombardi's stomach was troubling him again, and he was taking pills to ease his gastric distress. But he was just where he wanted to be on a sunny day in paradise, hacking away on a Hawaiian golf course with Wellington Mara, Tex Schramm, and friends. The work of the NFL League meeting was over for March 26, 1970, and it was time to play. They were well into the back nine when Lombardi noticed a golf cart hurtling their way, and a woman waving her arms and screaming at them. "Who the hell is that?" he muttered.
Vinny, it's your wife," said Mara.
And so it was. Marie had commandeered a cart and gone driving all over the course looking for him.
"She's having twins! She's having twins!"
she shouted, breathlessly.
"Who's having twins?" Lombardi asked.
"Your daughter, dummy! Susan! She's having twins!" Paul Bickham, their son-in-law, had just called to report that Susan was in the delivery room, and the doctor had discovered that she was giving birth to twins. Lombardi did what any golf addict might do. He smiled and kissed his wife and told her that he would meet her back at the clubhouse when the round was over. Then teed one up and, as Schramm later recalled, just whammed it. He was so proud. When he returned to the clubhouse, Marie was there. Nothing yet. While they waited, they drank and giddily warbled silly nursery rhymes. Georgie Porgy Puddin' and Pie had a set of twins and made 'em cry. Georgie was Paul's nickname. Finally, the good news arrived. Susan had delivered two healthy babies, a 5-pound, 14-ounce girl named Marie Ann, and a 6-pound, 10-ounce boy named Paul. Susan was back in her hospital room when her parents reached her on the phone. "My father was absolutely elated," she said later. "He said, 'Well, Susan, you have been unpredictable for 24 years, and damned if you haven't kept true to your word.' Because nobody knew I was having twins. And he said, 'Congratulations, I'll be there as soon as I can get there.'" Marie flew directly to Chicago to help out. Susan had 3 infants in diapers then and no cribs. But Lombardi had other obligations, speeches, business seminars, contract negotiations, and couldn't make the trip. In the second week of May, he and Marie went to New York for his induction into the Fordham Hall of Fame and stayed through the Mother's Day weekend. Their son, Vincent, was in Manhattan for a training program for stockbrokers, and Jill had come out to visit. The foursome met on the evening of May 9th at the Waldorf Astoria, then continued their evening at P.J. Clark's Saloon, where they were joined by little brother Joe and his wife, Betty. Jill sat next to her father-in-law most of the night and had an unusually intimate discussion with him. It was a tumultuous spring. Only 10 days earlier, Nixon had ordered the bombing of Cambodia, a decision that sparked protests across the country, culminating in the tragedy at Kent State University in Ohio, where National Guardsmen shot and killed 4 young people on May 4th. Just trying to make her way around New York, Jill had been caught in a series of protests and counter-protests, a demonstration near the United Nations decrying the Kent State killings, then a patriotic showing of hard hats near Wall Street. Lombardi talked to her about those events and the effect that parents can have on children. He gushed about Vincent II, his grandson, what a sensitive child he was, how understanding and patient Vincent and Jill were with him, and how perhaps he might grow up to be less alienated than the current student generation. Lombardi was in a rare self-reflective mood, bittersweet as he looked back on his own role as a parent. "I made so many mistakes with my kids," he confided to Jill. "I was too hard." "You can't be too hard on them. You have to be more understanding." When the group finally emerged from P.J. Clark's, they encountered a street woman selling flowers. Jill thought the flowers looked old, as though they had been taken from a graveyard. But Lombardi pulled a wad of bills out of his pocket and bought them all, handing some to Jill, some to Marie, and some to Betty. The next day, they all drove out to Sheepshead Bay to visit Harry and Mattie for a Mother's Day dinner. As everyone sat around talking, Vince fell asleep on his mother's sofa. "You're tired," Mattie said when he woke up. "I'm getting old," Vince said. "I'm getting old," his mother responded. "Yeah," he said, "but I'm always tired, more tired than usual." Lombardi had been named Salesman of the Year that spring by the Direct Selling Association and was in more demand than ever as an after-dinner speaker. His standard fee was $5,000. Sometimes he kept the money, other times he donated it to charity. 2 days after his New York visit on May 12th, the Independent Insurance Agents of Wisconsin brought him to Milwaukee for a luncheon address. He gave his standard speech about the zeal to win and the need for discipline, but the events of the last few weeks had clearly affected him. In recent months, his speeches had become increasingly strident, as he complained that protesters were breaking the law with no recrimination. But the killings at Kent State jolted him. "The way to treat violence is not with violence," he said in Milwaukee. "That only snowballs it." While issuing his traditional call for discipline, he began acknowledging that the voices of the young protesters should be heard. "I think the students have a great deal to say, but I don't think violence, disruptions, and burning are the right way to do it." From Milwaukee, Lombardi traveled north to Green Bay, which still seemed almost lost in time, removed from the turmoil of the big cities and major college towns. He arrived in time for a 3:30 golf match with Jack Kepler at Oneida Golf and Riding, his old course. This was his first visit to Green Bay since he'd left for Washington more than a year earlier, and there was some concern about lingering hard feelings. But he was welcomed back by old friends and journalists who wished he'd never left. Kepler had called Lee Remmel of the Post-Gazette the day before and alerted him that the old man was coming. "Would you like to interview him?" Kepler asked, to which Remmel responded, "Is the Pope Catholic?" Remmel arrived at Oneida just after Lombardi had finished a round of 84, about his norm. He was in the locker room getting ready to head upstairs to the Calcutta room to play gin when Remmel laid eyes on him. He was naked to the waist, wearing a pair of light blue slacks, and Remmel was struck by what he took to be the coach's trim, tan, vibrant appearance. "Coach, you look great," Remmel said.
"I feel wonderful," Lombardi said, breaking into his toothy smile.
Later, as Lombardi and his cronies were playing gin, the Press Gazette's Art Daly approached the table. "Jack and all those guys were sitting around, and I went in and saw Vince, and knelt down beside him and said, 'Vince, you never should have left here.'" Daly recalled. And those eyes of his, they bubbled up like crazy. Daly, too, came away thinking Lombardi looked good and tan. Lombardi visited all of his stations of the cross during his 2 days in Green Bay. He stayed at the home of Dick and Lois Borgannon, visited with the Gray Ghost and Ole, and they both gave him big hugs, no hard feelings, drove out to his old house on Sunset Circle, paid a visit to Father Spaulding at Resurrection and Father Burke at St. Norbert, went to Mass at St. Willibrord, and swung by Lambeau Field, where he walked up to the second floor and surprised Ruth McCloskey and the other secretaries. There was another round of golf the second day down at North Shore in Nina with Kepler, Doc Brusky, and Judge Robert Perrins, known to his pals as the One-Armed Bandit. He had lost his right arm and played a mean round of golf with his left hand. Perrins showed up in a pair of fake mutton-chop sideburns, teasing Lombardi about the mod hairstyle sported by a few of his redskins. That night, the same gang that used to gather in the basement rec room at Sunset Circle reassembled on a boathouse on the Fox River and toasted Vince. It was only when he was alone with Dick Borgannon during the final hours of the visit that Lombardi confided his troubles. He didn't want to alarm anyone, so he told the others that he was feeling good, Lombardi said, but in fact he was not. He was having problems with his stomach, kidneys, and bowels, he said. According to Lois Borgannon's later recollection, her husband told her that Lombardi had said he'd had a physical but wouldn't have a proctoscopy. Dick bawled him out and told him, "Don't be foolish and go in there and do something about it." A few weeks later, he at last reached Chicago to see his daughter and her infant twins. He'd come to town for a Boy Scouts of America awards luncheon at the Conrad Hilton Hotel, where he was joined by David Carley, his old business partner. Carley noticed that Lombardi didn't want to eat his meal that day, and was so tired later that he insisted on taking a cab to travel 3 blocks. Carley's last memory of Lombardi was of the two men standing on the sidewalk arguing about Bobby Kennedy and Spiro Agnew. Lombardi said he liked them both, a notion that infuriated Carly. That's impossible. You cannot like both of those men except on a purely personal basis, because they stand for things that are completely different, Carly said. But Lombardi meant it. He liked the way Agnew stood up for his country, but he also loved Bobby Kennedy's energy and his urgency to solve problems.